Well, somebody will probably label me a prude or take a few shots at me for saying this on the comments if they don't agree with what I have to say. But I think a key aspect of this is men learning that self-control, chastity, is a supreme form of love.
Fool me, we can't get fooled again.
Arf, hounds of heaven. Jesus loves you and is there for you. Welcome back in to the David O. Gray Show. Off code and unscripted. Got one thing for you today. Got Chad Giudice. He's an award-winning author and national Catholic speaker. He's on the show. So let's get into that. And let me know what you think in the comment box below. Chad Giudice is a nationally recognized motivational speaker and award-winning Catholic author, a former teacher in the theology department of two Catholic high schools in Lafayette, Louisiana for 17 years. He's the author of three inspiring pro-life faith books whose central character is his second son who was born with spina bifida. The books are Waiting for Eli, A Father's Journey from Fear to Faith, Eli's Reach on the Value of Human Life and the Power of Prayer, and Growing with Eli, Our Journey into Life and Light. Eli's Reach was named the best book by a small publisher in 2013, and Growing with Eli received honorable mention in the category of Family Life in 2019 by the Catholic Press Association. His articles have been published in the New York Post, the National Catholic Register, The Word Among Us. He's been a guest on national TV and radio shows, including EWTN's The World Over with Raymond Arroyo. Catholic TV Seize the Day and Catholic Answers Live. Chad has earned, this is his background as far as his CV. He's earned his certificates in theology, apologetics, philosophy, church history, Old Testament and New Testament studies, and a history of the Roman Rite from the New Thomas Institute, run by Dr. Taylor Marshall. He's advanced catechist and director of religious education certificate from the Franciscan Catechetical Institute in Steubenville, Ohio. In the last 10 years, he has given presentations to more than 100 audiences in 17 states, addressing man-to-man conferences, respect life gatherings, leading retreats, and conducting parish, lintel, and advent missions. His website is his name, the chadjudice.com, chadjudice.com. And make sure you subscribe to his YouTube channel. You just look it up on YouTube. I'll post a link below. But now he's on the David O. Gray Show. Welcome in.
Well, good morning, David. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. It's a pleasure to have you here. Glad to really meet your acquaintance. You have done some phenomenal work, man, and just want to have a conversation with you about what's going on. But as we get started, just if you guys hop over to Dr. Taylor Marshall's channel or just type in Chad's name into the YouTube, you can see the interview he did over there with Dr. Taylor Marshall. He'll a little more into his background so you can find out more. We're not going to do a repetition of that show, but just the skinny. Tell us a little bit about your faith journey.
So basically, I'm born and raised Catholic my entire life, but I was raised during a time period probably in the early 80s and 90s when catechesis wasn't very solid. My parents are boomers, so they weren't really well formed. Through college, and I kind of left the faith. I didn't really leave the faith. I went to Mass, and I probably received Holy Communion in a rather unworthy manner many times, being kind of ignorant. I wasn't living a very virtuous life or a life of sanctifying grace, but I never left the faith completely, but I was never there completely because I never fully understood it. And then when I got out of college, I had a degree in secondary education and I had an opportunity to teach in the Dawson school system at three different Catholic schools for close to 17 years. And when I was making the transition from my first place of employment to my second place of employment, St. Thomas More Catholic High School, one of my former students asked me a question I'd never been asked before. He said, hey, Coach Giudice, what's your greatest fear? And I told him my greatest fear would be to have a child with a mental or physical handicap because I was such a perfectionist. Wow. I didn't think I'd handle that very well. Well, I finished up my time over there and I moved on to my new position. I really didn't give that statement a second thought and had no idea that in 4 short years, that statement would become a reality. In the midst of our second pregnancy, my wife and I discovered in a 16 to 18 week ultrasound that our second child was diagnosed with a birth defect so severe that 80% of the couples that get that diagnosis in the pregnancy choose abortion. And my wife and I chose to pray for a miracle. My son was diagnosed. You mentioned the condition in the bio just a few moments ago when you introduced me, but he was diagnosed with a very severe birth defect called spina bifida. And he had the most severe form of spina bifida. It's called a myelomeningocele, a medical term. It means when the meninges of a spinal cord push through a hole or opening in the child's back that doesn't form properly within the first 6 to 8 weeks of pregnancy. And your neural tube is your spinal cord, so it's attached to your brain. And it pulled his brain back and allowed the front part of his head to fill up with water, causing a condition known as hydrocephalus. And before we got pregnant and during the last 21 years or so, my wife has been a neonatal intensive care unit nurse at a hospital. So she took care of like children with severe issues within a utero and following their birth in a premature manner. But there were no neurosurgeons on staff at our hospital when we got this diagnosis about our son. And these are the types of physicians that have to be there immediately following birth, like to provide the type of care that a child like this would need. Yeah. So we didn't really have a whole lot of information about what his condition was about. And when we got home that night and we were reading some of the medical literature that was sent to us by the maternal fetal specialist, we realized that, like I said, 80% of the people that get this diagnosis choose abortion. 75% of children with this severe of a birth defect will cause an unexplainable miscarriage in the mother prior to 20 weeks. And if we made it throughout the entire gestation of the pregnancy, when he was born, within 72 hours, he would need major surgery on his spinal cord and on his brain. And even if both those surgeries were completely successful, basically we were told that he would never walk. He would be severely mentally disabled and he would have all types of health issues. And my wife, in a moment of fear and being paralyzed by that, stood up and looked at me with tears in her eyes and said, "Hey, you know, I think I'm going to hell." I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "Well, you know, I'm actually thinking about aborting the baby." And I grabbed her, and I know it was the Holy Spirit. I just said, "Hey, it's not your fault. It's not my fault. God sent us this child for a reason. We got to trust in him the way our oldest son." We had a 3.5-year-old son at the time, and we'd had no complications in our first pregnancy. So there really wasn't any reason to think we'd have any in this one. Yeah. Trust in us. And the following day at Mass at the Catholic high school I was teaching, the very gospel that I had referenced was read aloud in Mass from Matthew 18, where Jesus says, "You know, let the children come to me. Unless you become like this child, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one child such as this receives me in my name." And the community was informed by a friend of mine that worked at the school. And it began a journey that's lasted for almost 13 years now. Our son is 13 years old. He's defied several medical odds that were stacked against him from the moment of his diagnosis. He's had 5 brain operations in his life, but if you talk to him and you had a conversation with him, even though he is a paraplegic, you would never know that. And he's a light in my life and a light to the light of others and other lives. And he's become an instrument, I think, that has made God's presence and work in our lives and the lives of other people more visible to them. So the first book that you mentioned I wrote about basically was our journey from the time of the diagnosis to the birth. And we had a lot of little miracles that happened along the way that kind of showed us God was there and that he was in control of the situation. And then after his birth, I began sharing the story all over the country. I dived into apologetics when people were asking me questions because it was such a Catholic story about my son. And then I started getting unsolicited responses from other people about how when they were in the midst of some type of faith crisis, regardless of what it was, they could find redemptive suffering by uniting their sufferings to Christ's suffering on the cross the way we did in our journey. And I told their stories in the second book.
Oh, okay.
And then my son had this major operation in Easter of 2011 where he almost died. And there's a shrine of Blessed Francis Xavier Silos. He's one miracle away from being canonized in New Orleans. It's about a mile away from the hospital. He interceded and kind of saved his life. And I have like a testimony from a doctor who did neural surgery for 40 years that couldn't explain what happened. Wow. I finished the second book with that. And then the third book was about the journey for me as a man, a husband, a father, and a teacher, and how this transformed me, my marriage, and brought my wife and I, you know, as a revert, finally, after being married for so long, into full communion with the Catholic Church on everything. And then we had our third son, who's my youngest. He's 8 now. And that was a kind of a product of that journey. And that's where the other book kind of leaves off. And it's kind of led us to the point we're at in our life right now. That's a very, it's a short synopsis of a very long and complicated story. Yeah. That's happened for over the last 13 years.
Yeah. What a rich story. And God bless you and your wife for having that testimony, and you having the courage to share it. And I know help many people with that, because these type of stories do help people, right? Because we all have our own experiences, but we were created for one another for one reason. You know, we could share the experience. I mean, the scripture itself is a testament of this, God's love story, and the failures and the successes that we have when we respond and don't respond to His grace. You and your wife definitely responded to God's grace, and it sounds like His grace has been sufficient for you. But I remember a little while, moment ago, you had talked about how a lot of people were asking you faith journeys, how that inspired you to dig deeper into your faith and apologetics. And you said then, you said that this was it's such a Catholic story. What made it a Catholic story?
Sure. So throughout the journey, throughout the pregnancy, I said that God kind of showed up in little ways to let us know, in, I call them God winks, or just signs that He was there in the midst of the whole thing. So a couple of examples from the original story is after the diagnosis, this whole Catholic school community of young people who are teenagers, 1,100 people in the school, were called to fervent prayer daily. And the mission statement of the school was St. Thomas More inspires students to be seekers of truth, individuals of character, and God's servant first. And it was one of the opportunities I'd seen since I'd been there, first time I had an opportunity to see since I'd been there. That mission state it fully lived out. And I made a retreat with the children not long after we got the diagnosis, and I asked them to pray. And when I saw them kind of surrender, as we all bombarded with this conscious idea by society subconsciously, everything's about us, totally abandon that mentality and begin fervently pray for an unborn child, it really inspired me. And when I got back to school after going to the retreat, there was a chapel at school that I prayed in every day. And there was always a parent or a child that was walking with me. And being Catholic my whole life, I'd always had a tie to the Blessed Mother. I'm actually born on March 25th, 1978, the Feast of the Annunciation. Mary's been in my life my entire life, but I felt called to pray the rosary. And the rosary became such a huge staple in this story because people were praying the rosary with me. And when I began to pray the rosary fervently for the first time in my life and actually learn how to pray it completely without help and really look at the mysteries of our Lord through the eyes of His mother from the moment of His conception to the moment of His natural death, things began to happen in our life, things that, you know, I really couldn't explain, and things that were happening to us, but other people at the school were kind of seeing from the outside looking in, but not having the purview from the inside looking out. We had several saints that we prayed novenas to, like my wife prayed a novena to Saint Therese of Lisieux, and somewhere along the line, without her mom or I even knowing it, her mom bought her a rose and gave her a rose, and the rose was a sign that Saint Therese was interceding for her. And then along the way, there was a little Christian community of Christian brothers, and they began praying for my son at the bequest or behest of one of my relatives. Mm-hmm. And they began doing it around the world because there was a particular Christian brother who had died in the 19th century, and they were asking his intercession, and he was in need of one miracle for his canonization throughout the entire pregnancy. And he had done two things during his life as an occupation. He had been a teacher, and he had been a nurse, and that's what my wife and I did for a living. So when we discovered that, and I share these elements of these signs from God throughout the entire walk of the pregnancy, they have a very Catholic flavor to them. And a lot of times people that were not Catholic don't understand Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, we're surrounded by a cloud of witnesses. Mm-hmm. Let us rid ourselves of our burdens and sin and cling to the race that lies before us and to cling to Jesus Christ as we're running it, because there's people that ran before us. And in Revelation chapter 8 and chapter 5, it talks about the prayers of the saints rising like incense, right? During the holy sacrifice of the mass, which is what Revelation is kind of pointing to, the sacred liturgy, and God receiving those prayers as a request from someone in the beatific vision. And there are helpers and they're our companions and they're our hope, because as human beings, we want to aspire to the level of holiness and sanctity that they have. And a lot of that's misunderstood. So when I would share the story, I needed to be able to clarify through apologetics and explain the Catholic teaching on that, and that it really is a reality. There is a church triumphant, there is a church suffering, and there's a church militant, and define for them who each one of those are. And because in Romans 8, it says that even death doesn't separate us from the love of God. No one can be in love with God more than the saints. And they're already they're already in heaven face to face, and they're our helpers and our guide, and they're there to intercede for us. And that we don't worship them. We venerate them, and that we have a participation theology where the more people that are participating in the very life of Christ, the more his presence is magnified in the world. So being able to explain those things to people really give the story a Catholic flavor. And then, of course, with my son's miracle in the second book with the surgeries on Easter Sunday and the weekend of Easter, once again, the intercession of a saint. So being able to clarify the necessity of the rosary as a biblical prayer, a staple of interior life for people on their journey in the Catholic faith, and understand the communion of saints was really part of the thrust of that. And also the Catholic understanding, which we'll talk about, I think, more today, of the whole entirety of the pro-life movement.
Yeah.
That was another reason why I felt it really is a Catholic story.
Yeah. Where were you on June 24th of this year? Where were you doing at about 9 a.m.?
June 24th, I was probably at work in my office.
So how did you find out about the whole Supreme Court decision? What happened? Were people texting you? How did you find out?
I was in my office, and there was a we have an intercom on the phone where I work, and someone with a lot of authority, ecclesiastical authority, came over the announcement and basically announced it that for all these years that we've been praying as members of the pro-life or anti-abortion movement that for Roe v. Wade to be overturned. It had been overturned. I had been following the Dobbs case and its path to the Supreme Court. I had been following the early release of the supposed decision and the controversy that was flooding across the country from the release of the early decision, and been monitoring it pretty closely. So I was just waiting for it to be made official.
Yeah, yeah. What was the reaction amongst, you know, people around you, and you know, as you head home? I mean, what was the flavor down there in your area?
Well, I think in my diocese in Lafayette, Louisiana, we're very blessed. It has a huge and rich, it's culturally Catholic, but it's also leaning back now to a lot of traditional devotions, which have always been prevalent here. 24-hour adoration chapels, devotion to the Blessed Mother. Our diocese is consecrated to Our Lady. And, a lot of people down here have been involved heavily in the pro-life movement for years. I think there was a sense of relief, a sense of celebration, and we should take a few days to celebrate. But I think also it's an awareness that now it didn't illegalize abortion. It just made it illegal to illegalize it. Legal to illegalize it within states. So it's still sent it back to the states. And I think we know that there's still a battle in front of us. And I think every pro-life person in Louisiana is excited about the decision, but knows that it's just a touchdown in the game. We haven't won the game. We still have to move the ball forward.
And what is the position of the the laws in Louisiana concerning abortion, pro-life? What is it?
I think we have we could make the case, I know we have in the past, of being one of the strongest pro-life states in the union, even before you had trigger laws take effect after the Roe versus Wade decision. I still, though, personally, once again, take exception to the rule of exception. Mm-hmm. We know that there's less than 1% of the time that these exception clauses actually come to fruition. Yet they paint them as the norm in order to make people that are opposed to abortion, even in those circumstances, look like extremists when they're not, they're not at all. It's an extreme circumstance when these things happen. I know that in most states, and some still here in Louisiana, the laws still allow exceptions for rape, for incest, for the health, quote unquote, health of the mother. I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. But the one that really strikes the most chord with me is fetal abnormality. Fetal abnormality would be something like what happened with my son. So somewhere between 16 and 20 weeks, we get this severe fetal abnormality diagnosis in the pregnancy. And it's my understanding from a lot of study about that, that these are the types of things that allow for late term abortions to take place up until birth or post birth, if the couple doesn't decide once they find out, or they don't find out about the birth defect until birth, which to me after birth is just infanticide. And it's still, if you're a quote unquote pro-life in those situations. And just to speak to the rape thing too, for a second, I have a biracial friend who's conceived in rape that does a huge amount of pro-life work in this diocese. And he is an amazing person. Mm-hmm. And I remember back in 2008, when I was still teaching civics and American history, because I taught that as well as theology in Catholic schools for almost 17 years. And I remember then presidential candidate Barack Obama in a interview with Rick Warren saying that, when does life begin? And his basic response was, that's above my pay grade. And when I was teaching it, I would always respond to him and I would say to my class, well, it's above my pay grade to decide the value of someone's life based on the way that they were conceived. When someone is conceived, regardless of the way that they were conceived, they have the same value as me. So to be consistently pro-life, or have the ethic of pro-life, and to have the complete Catholic view of it, which has been this view from the beginning of Christianity in the first century, which we can see in historical record and has never changed, that mm-hmm. even in those exceptions, it's not okay to have an abortion. That person's life has value, intrinsic value, and their dignity and integrity cannot be repeated. And there's an irreplicable strand of DNA that was formed in that moment of conception that will never happen again. And that God has a purpose for their life. And to me, it's just inconsistent to say I'm pro-life in all situations except these, because it just basically allows you to still deem a certain group of human beings outside the realm of personhood and to be discriminated against.
Yeah. And I have really no respect for people who, at least their intellectual capacity or their capacity to be honest, who want to just say, they want to use just talking points, you know, especially the one that says abortion, you know, is my body, my choice, right? Or this autonomy argument, that whole thing. I really think the honest way that a person can go into this and say it's okay to take another human life, the only honest thing they can say is that it's self-defense. They're saying that I'm choosing my life over theirs because of my own self-interest. And they look at the child as some sort of threat. It's just self-defense. That's the only honest argument they can say. And we can refute that, I think, clearly in a number of ways. Even self-defense, we look in like the just war doctrine. It has limitations, right? You just, so even the self-defense argument has you know, its limitations. But what do you think of, it's troubling to me, right? The fact that the law was changed, but I don't know, like, one heart that was changed, Chad. And if you're listening on the podcast version, we're speaking with Chad Judice. You can find him at Chad Judice. That's ChadJudice.com. Also, check out his YouTube channel. He's a nationally known Catholic speaker. He's an author. Check him out. He's appeared on the World Over Live. He's been on Catholic Answers Live. So he's been around. Check him out. That's Chad Judice. And we're speaking with him about his faith journey and the story of his son and some current events. And so, yeah, what are your thoughts about that? Because I started to say it's concerning to me that we changed the law, but man, I don't know one person whose mind was changed by the law being changed. I just don't.
Well, I don't think you can legislate morality. I think that, you know, a lot of people in the United States, especially with the post-conciliar idea of relegating the kingship of Christ to the eschaton rather than the social kingship of Christ, where the creator is governing all of creation and that all human law should reflect divine law. This has not been transposed in people's hearts and minds. Number one, because it's been put on the back burner and kind of forgotten about because of this idea of separation of church and state. But also, I think, you know, when you talk about the change of someone's heart, I've long tried to express when I share my son's story, and this is why I've gone out and given it, is that we oftentimes in the anti-abortion or pro-life movement, we lead with arguments and then we try to follow up with a story that gives an example, right, of the principles of the argument. What I've tried to do with my son's story is just the opposite. Like Jesus taught in parables. And by the time you got to the end of the parable, the moral principle that was so relevant to the story was so clear to everyone. There was only one thing to do. We either accept it or reject it. And it was an effective way to bring people's hearts into conformity with the truth that stood before them in the person of Jesus Christ and what he was revealing. My son's story is that story. It kind of puts a face on the pro-life movement. And, you know, that's had the pro-life movement has had courageous people, right, who have basically espoused the principles, moral principles and truths of the pro-life movement, but it's lacked a story, one that like connects those principles with reality. And I feel like Eli's story really does that. A story of an unborn child that was crying out from the womb, that was heard by a community of believers, teenagers who in the 2008-2009 school year, when they prayed that hard for an unborn child in his mother's womb, whether they realized or not, they acknowledged he was a person. And before he took his breath, and since then, he has been an instrument that made God's work and presence in the lives of other people more visible to them. And I really don't know like what the future holds for my son, but I do know that at 16 weeks of pregnancy, if we hadn't have chosen the path less traveled, that we'd have ended a life that wasn't ours to take. And we'd have missed out on coming home and seeing a beautiful, vibrant, now 13-year-old child that has defied every medical and physical odd science stacked against him from the moment of his conception. And it's kind of like, you know, Uncle Tom's Cabin was a story written, it's a fictitious story, but based on true events, that took a moral issue that had been relegated to a political one about the scourge of slavery and made it a moral one in the conscience of people. And when the Civil War took place, it brought about the end of that because it became a moral dilemma for people in their hearts and minds because the story and the message it was sending was received. And it reinforced all the principles about the dignity and integrity of people being denied in the institution of slavery and then being relegated to less than being a person. And I feel like the pro-life movement and the anti-abortion movement, especially now, and even in those situations where there's exceptions in these state laws, need a face, a human face. And I think that will change hearts and minds of men of goodwill. It will not change everyone. But people of goodwill who are seeking the truth and are open to it, it will change their hearts and minds. And I have gotten significant feedback from people that have heard me just share the story in realms of different capacities of walks in life dealing with this, who said, I have remained quiet on this because I didn't feel like I had anything to say or I felt like I was judging, but your story has shown me that I must speak out, that I was okay with abortion as a woman, but now I am not.
Yeah.
So it has that power. And I know there are many stories like that, but this one is just, I think, a unique one. And I think men have a lot to say, because if you look at the statistics, men are the ones forcing women into many abortions.
Yeah.
So men should be speaking just as loudly as women are in opposition to what I think is the human rights issue of our time.
Yeah.
Abortion.
Man, yeah, there's a lot, man, that's a lot there. I think the pro-abortion movement, I think they've probably been ahead of where you're talking about on their end, the whole thing of shop my abortion, right? It's telling a story.
Yes.
I mean, that's exactly what they're doing. They're not approaching it as, you know, I've been in sales probably most of my life, except for a couple of stints in accounting and auditing and, you know, teaching. But I think I've been in sales for most part of my life and been really good at sales. And one thing that we teach is that follow up the sale with a personal story, right? And sales is just the opposite, right? We present the product. You know, some salespeople, they may come in and try to be the buddy, you know, make some common interest. Hey, you know, let's see, you're sure you went to Ohio State, blah, blah, blah. Other people come in, I think the more effective one is come in as an expert on a subject, offer some sort of value and sell that way. But then it's always, you know, we'll follow that up with some sort of personal story to get the customer to relate with the product. But I really like your approach it's telling a story.
Yes.
And because we're all human beings and we can all relate in some degree. So yeah, man, I think that's so effective. I think, yeah, I would love for you to get that message out more deeply. You're just the person, you and your wife are just the people to do that. And you know, I don't know if you've seen the video. It's, you know, YouTube suppresses it, but I have a video that talks about my experience with abortion in college. You know, doing, I wasn't a Christian or anything like that. You know, real oddly, I had this idea that I wanted to wait to have sex until I met my wife, right? So I don't know where that came from, because I was in church, as they say, in with Protestants. But yeah, doing the wrong things. And so we had one child, a woman I eventually married, and then she aborted the second child. And it just led me, man, I had never felt rage like that in my entire life. Never felt rage like that. I just felt something had been taken from me. And I wanted to get revenge on a person who took it. It was just, I never felt anger like that in my entire life. And I think it deeply affected me going forward in a lot of ways that I'm still, you know, unpacking. But so even though, we have a lot of men, I think, 80% by some numbers, abortions are coerced by family members or by men. So yeah. And I think, you know, you see in chat, you see all these men out here at these marches, right?
Yeah.
And you hear, you know, these celebrities talking about this. Let me know what you think about this. I have two opinions about these people. These not even men in my book. Not even protecting women. The first duty of a man is protect women and protect his child. They do neither. But I have two, so I put them in two categories. They're men who have just been effeminized, somehow raised maybe by their mama or influenced just this matriarchal society that we're in, and just haven't taken leader position, right? And, and other ones are men who pay for abortions, men who are using women for sex. And so they're like, yes, woman's body, her choice, because they're protecting their, what they want to do with women, just use them for sex and throw them away. Those are my two thoughts on those men. Who are these men in your book? Who do you think they are?
You mentioned a word that I think defines them definitively, and I think it's been propagated by feminism. It's effeminacy. And when I speak of effeminacy, I'm not speaking in the modern genre of a man who acts like a woman. I'm referring to St. Thomas Aquinas and his Summa Theologiae, where he speaks about someone who's adversely addicted to pleasure and will pursue it and will not do something difficult for the benefit first and foremost of themselves, or more importantly, for the benefit of someone else.
Yeah, repeat and that. That's really good. Repeat that.
Sure. So I can't remember exactly where it's at in the Summa off the top of my head, but if you look in the Summa Theologiae, he talks about this vice against perseverance. It's called effeminacy. And it's basically the idea, like I said, that you're addicted to pleasure to such an extent that you will pursue pleasure and refuse to do something difficult as a man, first and foremost for your own benefit, but more importantly, for the benefit of the people that you love, which is a sacrificial act of love that emulates the sacrificial act of Christ on the cross, which is what true manhood is all about. And if you don't have that model or any type of point of reference for that, you're not going to pursue that. And I think that when a man forfeits, and this, of course, is the part of our teleology that comes from the idea that we have material and efficient causes, but we also have a final causality. And our final causality and our masculinity and femininity give us specific roles in our gender. And that was programmed into us in creation. And that a man, as you said rightly, is a protector and provider, most first and foremost for his family, not necessarily just in a material sense or a temporal sense, but more importantly, in a spiritual sense. Yeah. And we have forfeited that in the home. And when you have that happen because a man is too effeminate, he's too addicted to pleasure to do the difficult thing to do that, his wife, through no fault of her own sometimes, will usurp it. And when she usurps that authority in the home, this is where you get men who have no father at all, right? Mm-hmm. They have no example of what that actual manhood looks like. And of course, if God is father and we're in a universal family and we don't have an imperfect, even though it is imperfect, image of fatherhood to compare ourselves, God to and his fatherhood, then we don't think fatherhood matters. And that's where these men, they're raised in this idea where this is what a man does. You know, he gratifies himself, and that's how he builds up his stature as a man. He's addicted to his hobbies, his intellectual laziness is an impediment to him learning the truth. Like you speak out, even though we have a moral obligation to do that, and they don't want to lead. And, you know, if you think about it, this is what happened in the garden. Adam was offered a chance. The first Adam was offered a chance to lay his life down for his bride. And he didn't want to do the difficult thing. He was effeminate, and Eve usurped his authority. And we know what happened. Spiritually, she was fooled, and then it led all of humanity, because Adam followed suit, into the detriment of original sin, which called for the necessity of Christ to come and redeem us and offer us the gift of salvation through his passion, death, and resurrection on the cross. But to restore masculinity and femininity to their true nature. And I think if you have that happening in the domestic church, and you can rebuild that from the inside out, starting with men, learning how to lead as priest, prophet, and king, as they share in the common priesthood of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
To teach, govern, and sanctify in their home, you'll stop breeding men with the mentality you speak of.
Yeah, and I think that's another aspect of, you know, my story with that first abortion, was that I wasn't leading, I wasn't being a man. I completely, you know, years later, perhaps even instantly, I kind of realized where she was at in her headspace. You know, we were in college, I was out there just doing, you know. Doing the thing, right? Of right. Thinking, you know, me out here messing with other women was, you know, was being a man was sure. Like, you know, that's kind of what, you know, I saw from my biological father. And not to make excuses, but, you know, your examples sure. Are your examples.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, I completely understand when she was at her space. She didn't feel safe. She didn't feel protected. And because of that, it was just like the alligator brain, just survival, right? It's just self-defense, you know, doing what I need to do. I feel like I need to survive in the space. Completely understood that. But yeah, I think you're so right about that's the consequence of not being men and making women feel safe. So those guys, I think if anyone in the audience, especially, I know you guys have a lot of you sit outside of abortion mills, and sometimes you talk to these men, you've probably seen them too, Che. You talk to these men and they don't even want the woman to go in. Right.
Yeah.
They're like, I don't want to do this either. And they're just, you know, and they're just like, out there, weak and helpless and can't defend the life of their child. And how do we get out of this space with men? Because like you said, if the vast majority of abortions are being coerced by the man or by family members or whatever, if we could stop that coercion, we could stop a lot of these murders. But how do we get there? What's some of your thoughts concerning that?
Well, somebody will probably label me a prude or take a few shots at me for saying this on the comments if they don't agree with what I have to say. But I think a key aspect of this is men learning that self-control, chastity is a supreme form of love. And that when we display non-physical and physical acts of love, as Pope St. John Paul II writes so eloquently about in the Theology of the Body, that every act of love, physical or non-physical act of love, should be total, free, fruitful, and faithful. And total gift of self, which actively wills the good of other, that's freely given because you really do want what's best for them, even to your own personal detriment in the moment. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of love that we've been, I guess, gifted to give. It needs to be fruitful spiritually because, of course, any non-physical act of love or physical act of love that is not in accord with something that's licit in the moral law, and the object mm-hmm. of a moral act has to be licit, then it's going to be detrimental to you and to the other person. And it's faithful to them and their eternal destiny. Chastity, I know it's, you know, people say it's an impossibility, but it's not. I mean, if with sanctifying grace, you can live a life of chastity. And I think men, when they can learn to govern their passions rather than their passions governing them, they can become the kind of men that a woman truly desires. And they can be that image of fatherhood for people even that didn't have a biological father in their life. If they could meet a man like that, that lived it and made it in his humanity real for them and possible for them through sanctifying grace, then if you're preserving the conjugal act for where it belongs in its right purpose, because you see the person that you're receiving as a gift that's been given to you that needs to be received in yourself as a gift to be given to that person, and the child that comes from it the ultimate gift, which images the inner life of the Trinity, a communion within a union of persons, right? That is generating life. It just changes the way you see other people. It changes the way you see the world. And I think you just have to do that one life at a time with one person you encounter at a time.
Yeah. And one child you raise at a time, right?
Amen. Amen.
We appreciate what you're saying here is that child murder in the womb is just a symptom of a much deeper issue, right? We have to fix something at its core, right? And, but God bless the pro-life movement. I mean, we have to keep doing the work where we can do the work. Yes. But this is a much deeper issue that Christ resolved on the cross, right? We would definitely have to keep turning to him as the solution. And also like what you said, because people listening to this conversation, like, oh man, these are, you know, especially someone who, you know, say a feminist, whatever, she's hopping into this conversation. Sure. And so what do these men know about my body? You know, these men are up here talking about something that they won't never experience, you know, this whole thing. But morality, anyone can talk about moral issues, right, Chad?
Right. I think so. And I think, you know, this, just to comment on what you said it twice in the interview, we don't understand my body and my choice. I think everybody understands after COVID mandates, my body and my choice. And I think the complete irony of the left propagating my body and my choice, when in fact, it's not just your body anymore. There are two bodies involved in the equation. And you're giving yourself permission to have bodily autonomy in those situations, but forfeiting that right for somebody else in another situation where they're being forced into something that is still considered to be a medical experiment is ultimate duplicity. And anybody with any kind of logic that takes 5 minutes to think about that would see that. And obviously, if that's the case, something can't be one thing while at the same time being the exact opposite. That defies the philosophical law of non-contradiction. Therefore, the argument doesn't have a leg to stand on intellectually. I know there's an emotive part of that. There's an emotional tie to that. Mm-hmm. And that you can get really emotionally tied to a fallacy and think that because you have very strong feelings about it, you're 100% right. But I think that if you look at it objectively, it's not a really good argument to make. And I think it's, once again, as you mentioned, we're treating symptoms. We're not treating the core issue. And the core issue is the fact of the matter is abortion is last ditch contraception. When contraception fails, people seek out abortion. Yeah. And at the root of abortion is contraception. So it's removing a contraceptive mentality that is one that is part of the culture of life and not the culture of death, as St. John Paul II spoke so eloquently of throughout his pontificate.
Speaking of young men, you were a teacher for a lot of years, and you know, I taught as well. And that's one thing I miss about teaching, just the relationship with kids, especially when I was in cities. A lot of the young girls, you know, didn't have maybe a father at home. You know, it didn't take too long in the school year where they started calling me dad. You know, it's always funny. And I was always scared that somebody's parent might show up with a child support order or something like that. Like, you know, like, no, we're not, it's just, you know. But yeah, I used to love the boys and the girls. One thing, the boys I used to mentor, I used to tell them and that, you know, there's a few questions, right? You just want to just get out there if you're interested in a girl. You know, I used to explain the, you know, courtship and that whole thing. Just ideas are just antithetical just in society today and Tinder and all that and Snapchat and hop into people's DMs, as they say, right? But, you know, try to explain, okay, this is what courtship is. It's not hopping into somebody's DMs and, you know, saying, you know, sending pics of your body parts. That's not what it's about. No. But one thing I should tell them, you know, there's just some fundamental questions you just, I think, that you want to just ask a young lady up front. One of them nowadays is, you know, are you, can I see your birth certificate? You know, are you biologically of my opposite? Are you my complementary gender naturally? You know,
yeah.
tell me about your chromosomes. You know, are they the same? Are they different? But that the other one, the second question is, when is it okay to kill life in a womb? And I always told the boys that if she says anything other than never, you know, you want to definitely approach that with caution. I just don't know if she's marriage material at that moment, right? That's someone who you want to pray for, yes. Have some sort of impact on her life in that regard. But she's not ready for marriage. What are your thoughts? Would you marry a woman who is so-called pro-choice? And should a woman entertain and I know you're a traditional Catholic. Sure. I know we don't encounter these type of women, you know, right. Typically, you know, at mass, but you know, should a woman entertain courtship with a man who think it's okay to kill a child in the womb? What's your thoughts there?
To quote one of my, to quote somebody who's frequently heard online, I'm just a dad on a webcam. This is just my opinion. but what I'm going to say is that, you know, I have you're making this very personal for me. I have a 17-year-old son who's mm-hmm. in high school, and he's never had a serious relationship with a girl. He's working a lot. I think it's not because he's not physically attractive. It's because he is, I think he's looking for the right kind of girl. And it's because of the formation he's received. And I think your advice is good advice. I think you could, once again, befriend one of these people. I think being a positive influence in their life and kind of being an example in your witness of your life to the countercultural nature of Christianity and the beauty of Catholicism would be something that influences them when they see that you're authentic and sincere because you do genuinely care about them in a relationship, getting to know them and not judging the intent, which with where they're coming from, because only God can do that, but just showing objective reasons why you don't think that's a good way to go. I would not recommend to my son to date someone with those worldviews. I wouldn't recommend if I had a daughter to date a man with those type of worldviews, because I just think that, as I mentioned earlier, emotions are very powerful. And when you get emotionally attached to somebody, sometimes it blinds you to things that are very important in the long run, right? That you don't see in that moment. And I think that courtship, as you mentioned earlier, should start with a platonic friendship, and that those questions and things should come out first. And that when you're courting someone, eventually they should be a true virtuous friend who really desires the same thing you desire for them, heaven. And if it is a male-female relationship, it should blossom, if it's God's will, into something more deep and beautiful later on. Even though I'm not opposed to getting married early in life, if you find the right person, I think that that's something you should do. For instance, my wife and I got married at 23. At the time, someone would say that's older, but I'm 44 years old. We've been married for, you know, close to 21 years. And honestly, when we went into our marriage, we were not where we are right now. So I'm not, no condemnation to anybody that, you know, is not at that place. And we didn't have all these things worked out. But I think now, if you're raised in a home where that's being shared by your parents and you've seen it as a young person, the person that you're looking for and you yourself are worth waiting for. And you can be patient and find them, and eventually the Lord will put them in your life. And you ask Our Lady to intercede, I think she'll lead you to that person.
Countries like Greenland, they're bragging about, you know, having 0% autism, right? Children born with autism, because there's doctors are recommending very strongly that they abort children with beautiful children with that are just different than us, right? Yeah. Just on a biological way. And man, I love, you know, I've met so many people with, you know, autism. And one thing I really appreciate about them is that besides all their little quirks they may have, is that they're just so completely honest. Remember, I used to be a delivery driver at Pizza Hut. There was this kid here. I think his name was Chris or something with a C. And he said, one day we're just there, you know, making boxes like you do at Pizza Hut. And he said, "Your laugh is obnoxious." Okay, right? You know, that was refreshing. Thanks for that. It is, and I just love that. You know, interacting with people who don't are not pretentious. And yeah, I really appreciate that. And but I want to ask you this, because you and your wife, you guys chose life in a circumstance when the you know, doctors would have recommended death. What do you find to be the case with married couples, those who choose death versus those who choose life? You and your wife, did that choice seem to bring you together? And if you think if you had chose death, does that seem to be something that tears marriages apart, because that's lasting. I mean, you guys just killed a child. You made a conscious decision to kill one of your own. That seems to be an impediment. That would be an impediment in the marriage going forward. I don't know. But what's your thoughts in that regard, in those two situations?
It's ironic you asked this question, because even though I don't say this when I give my formal presentation and share the journey with my son that I've been given all over the country for so long, I do give this in some after sessions with Q&A. When I think back on it now, where I was at in my life and where we were at in our marriage, it certainly isn't where we are now. I can honestly say that, you know, we could have gone home after getting the diagnosis. We could have said absolutely nothing to anybody. I could have taken her to an abortion clinic. We could have had an abortion. We could have come back and told people she had some kind of spontaneous miscarriage.
Yeah.
And we could have lied about it. And nobody would have known but her and I. But the truth is, God would have known, and each one of us would have known. And I can honestly tell you that bringing Eli into the world solidified our marriage. It has transformed us into the couple God intended us to be when he brought us together.
I mean, where were you? Where were you like 13 years ago? I mean, as a couple.
I was a very typical effeminate man, as I mentioned earlier, who was addicted to pleasure. He wouldn't do difficult things first and foremost for his own benefit, but much less for the benefit of somebody else. Wow. I was a Piccadilly Catholic. I pick and choose what I liked about my faith. I didn't realize it was an all-inclusive meal. I had ways of justifying it. I was visibly ignorant. I could have found out, but I chose not to because it was too inconvenient for my lifestyle. I was a very selfish person. Wow. And what the Lord has done in my life and in my family's life through my son, who's been that instrument of selflessness and self-giving love and a projection of outwardness rather than inward focus, is he's taken that and manifested in our life and the life of our family. And I do believe that it's very possible that would he have made the other decision, my wife and I would be divorced today.
Wow. Yeah. I think that's because that's really beautiful. And because I think what we see, you even see this with, in children outside the womb, you oftentimes see when a married couple lose a child, man, that's tough. You see a lot of divorce from that. However the child died, it's tough. Because you lost a part of both of you. I doubt Greenland is keeping statistics or whatever, but I wouldn't be surprised if that leads to a lot of divorce. Yeah.
Well, I think through the other thing about identifying a pre-existing condition and eliminating it is pretty much the same mentality you take into IVF if you're infertile and you don't want to work with what is a natural process with an OBGYN that's willing to do it to help you be fertile if it's possible, or even consider adoption, is you're turning the child into a commodity that you'd like to purchase and fine-tune to your liking instead of receiving them as a gift from God. And that's just a, once again, we're talking, you and I have been, it's a changing of mentality. It's a changing of heart, mm-hmm. changing of mind. It's, you can't argue. I mean, I can argue this all day long, but if you disagree with me, you're just going to come up with reasons to justify it. It needs to be a change in your heart, right? To really manifest
itself. Yeah. I mean, what definitely changed me was, you know, I definitely had that experience early in college with the woman I eventually married. But, you know, I turned out to be like a trash husband, you know, adultery, you know, I ended up paying for abortions. I just a horrible human being who thought I had all the answers, thought I was the smartest guy in the room, had the money. It's just, you know, I look back on my old self, you know, I wish I could just go back in time, you know, just drop kick him. Like, dude, grow up, be a man. What are you doing? You got a beautiful family, protect them, you know. But you know, we have our journey, and by the mercy of God, his grace, yes. You know, I'm
and I just want to say, I've heard your testimony. You mentioned earlier, you have a video that may be suppressed. I have watched that video, and it's really what drew me to watching more of your content. And And I admire, I mean, look, it's not in this race that we're running. It's not about where you start, man. It's about where you finish.
Right.
And we all have a different path. And, self-recollection and understanding and embracing your cross is the conviction. Embracing the difficulty is what changes you. And you know, Paul says in Galatians 6:14, if I boast of anything, let me boast of the cross of Jesus Christ, through which the world has been crucified to me and I to the world. And I think that's what in your story, in your suffering, in your journey, that's what happens. Yeah. And I think that's in anybody's story. I just think we have to be able to articulate a story that is relatable to them and their humanity for them to realize that they can't have Easter Sunday in their life without Good Friday. And we cannot become the men we're created to be without sanctifying grace. And the cross is what brought it in my life. And I believe with very, very deep conviction, that's what will bring it in the lives of many other people as well.
Yeah, because it's true. And I read the catechism, you know, and that Chad, when we're speaking with Chad, Judice. Oh, man. I knew I was going to mess up. Chad Judice. You can find him at his website, Chad Judice. That's ChadJudice.com. Or just type his name into the Google or the DuckDuckGo and his YouTube channel and everything. So make sure you subscribe to his YouTube channel. He's putting out some good content over there. But yes, I read the catechism, Chad, and that's actually the first thing I believed in the old Green Catechism when I read it. You know, I was thinking about the Catholic Church. I said, let me read this catechism because I'm sure they're wrong. They don't understand Christianity. You know, this catechism changed my life. But I didn't read the book from the beginning to the end. I just went back to the index. Said, let me see what they think about this. Let me see what they think about that.
Sure.
And that was the first Catholic teaching I believed. And to open up the door. Okay, I said, well, okay, that's phenomenal. That makes sense. If they're right about this, what else are they right about?
Amen.
And so that really began my journey into the Catholic Church. But you speak to a lot of people who are not Catholic, and there are a lot of non-Catholics in the pro-life movement. Sure. What is that? What are your thoughts on how's that different for non-Catholics and for Catholics in the pro-life movement? Is there a distinction or some things we could say about that? And is it opportunity? I know you've been using it as an opportunity to evangelize. Sure. Is that an effective space to evangelize what the Catholic Church teaches? Because it's true, it doesn't change.
I think so. I think once again, this goes back to the heart of the problem, which is original sin, but springing out of original sin is this scourge of contraception. I think contraception is a root issue. And I think for pro-life Protestants who say I'm pro-life in most instances, right? I heard somebody on Fox News on a talk show say that on 4th of July, and I wanted the yak. So it's like, you know, so certain instances are rape, incest, and health of the mother, or maybe fetal abnormality. You know, I think that they need to realize that there is a flaw in their argument and that it can be easily pointed out. If two heterosexuals can reduce intercourse to instead of its primary purpose being the procreation of children to an act of pleasure, and then they get to decide when procreation enters the story, that foments to homosexuals being able to justify sex only as an act of pleasure. Yeah. It has nothing to do with procreation. I just think, and these are like anti-life mentalities. So if it's a contradiction in your pro-life stance. And I think if you really examine that, the truth of that teaching will bring you to fruition that the Catholic Church does have the fullness of teaching on this particular moral issue that's been revealed by God in the person of Jesus Christ and his humanity. But also I think sometimes I've done research on other quote unquote Christian denominations. And if I'd have gone to a pastor in one of those church parishes and presented them with my situation, some of them would have told me based on their moral theology that it had been okay to kill my kid. And from what I know in my heart and my mind to be true, once again, it violates the law of non-contradiction. And honestly, that's not a brand of Christianity I'm really interested in. And I don't think any Christian should be interested in that brand of Christianity because it doesn't represent the fullness of revelation.
Yeah, we don't deserve something that is unlike God. So Protestantism changes, it fluctuates. Yes. Just so many years ago, they were not on board with divorce. They were not on board with gay marriage. Yes. And I'm speaking in generally. I know Joe Smo's little Catholic Protestant church down the street.
Right.
I know Pastor Bob hasn't changed. But after Pastor Bob leaves, you know.
Yeah.
So, and man, that's such the beauty with why I love so much the Catholic Church. Is that it's just so consistent and it's true and it's most like God who doesn't change, right? God is the same God today as he is yesterday. And so is our dogmatic teachings. And man, what as we wrap up, and again, we're speaking with Chad Judice.
Judice.
Why Judice. Does it sound like?
But hey, look, it's no, look, this is, I'm not, it's no big deal. I get this all the time. We had a little conversation before on air. People call my house. Is Mr. Judice there? Mr. Judice? Mr.
Yeah, Justice. I think when you just said that, when I mispronounced it, I said Judice. People, you have a name. So tell me about your story from elementary school to now. No.
Actually, in Southwest Louisiana, where I'm from, it's a French Acadian. My name is French, so most people understand Judice is French.
See, Judice. You should have told me that from the beginning.
I apologize. I get that, so right? it's no big deal. Believe me, I'm not offended. I mean, I did a talk in a church in a diocese of Wisconsin, Green Bay, Wisconsin, and I had three people do the same thing you just did. One of them got up at Mass, made an announcement, called me Justice. The one at the end called me Judice. The priest called me Judice. And I got up and said, hi, my name is Chad Judice. Which one is it? And, you know, it's trying to like break the ice a little bit to invite people to come hear the story, but it's okay. Like, it's fine. It's not a big deal. But if you think of it from a French standpoint, it's Judice. And that's in most French Acadians down in Southwest Louisiana are very familiar with French names.
I get that.
No worries. And believe me, I couldn't pronounce a Polish name up there to save my life correctly. So no barring on anybody in those. Yeah.
I have a friend down there. He's a pastor at ERAF Church. Man, I forget the name of it.
Oh, he was the former pastor there. Yeah, he was Andre, my pastor for a while, Father Andre Metrejean.
Yeah, Mr. Jean.
Yeah.
See, now you get Judice. There it is, right there.
It is. There. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So as we wrap up with Chad Judice, and you can find him, like I said, you can find his website under that name and the YouTube channel. What are your some of the things that you just want to leave us with about your faith journey and where you're at now and what's going on in society?
I want to just try to be a light. I know there's a lot of negativity about a lot of things going on in the world, and I think it's easy to fall into despair or discouragement. For me, my fundamental understanding of the church is just like Jesus Christ. It's fully human and fully divine, and it has not lost its indefectibility. Although there are some people in the magisterium, in the human side, that have made mistakes throughout history and are possibly making mistakes now, don't let that deter you from the fullness of the faith that still can be found in that church. That's what's convicted me of Catholicism. And also, after teaching church history, just knowing that this many human beings throughout 2,000 years have had chances to destroy the church, either intentionally or unintentionally, from the inside and out, and have failed, show that it's a divine institution, not a human one. That's what convicted me, besides my suffering and the doctrine of redemptive suffering. I really would encourage people to take a look at the doctrine of redemptive suffering. Redemptive suffering is key. And right now, suffering is very unpopular in the world. Mm. And it's a thing that deters people away from faith. And I want to encourage people to go to my YouTube channel, where I have stories of people who embrace suffering and how it changed their life spiritually and how it brought them closer to Christ, not further away from him. And that, to me, that's the best testimony for that. And to encourage them, look at their own suffering, allow them to enter into it, to bring you to a deeper place and sanctification and holiness in your own life. And to check out the story, unfortunately, because it's about a controversial topic, if my son had beat cancer or something else that's generic, I think this story would have gotten a lot more play, even inside the church, because some people are kind of hesitant to allow people to speak, especially a man to speak on these topics. But my wife left a 21 year of nursing, a career to be home with our family. And because my son is going to be homeschooled, that has special needs, that the story is about. And my speaking is a way that in my personal time, I can supplement my income for my family.
Yeah.
And I would appreciate opportunities, even if it's just in a Zoom conversation with people that have large audiences on YouTube.
Yeah.
To get this message out, and especially in like-minded Catholics and Catholics of both of all stripes, I'm willing to have conversations with people on all ends of the spectrum of Catholicism. And I just want I'd like an opportunity to have more interviews like this. And thank you so much for giving me that opportunity with your audience. I truly appreciate it. And so does my family.
Yeah, it was a great conversation. I really appreciate you coming on. David, a great off code and unscripted. And people at your website, Chad Judice, that's where they can book you, or do they go to CatholicSpeakers.com, or where do they go to book you?
I am on CatholicSpeakers.com, but I do a lot of my own personal booking. So if somebody contacts me directly through my own email or through my website, there's a button that says contact us. And I will reach out to them in a phone call or through an email conversation, and we can talk about what they want to do to book me to come to an event.
Yeah, okay, yeah. You guys, get Chad in your parish at your conference. Let's get more of this story out. Appreciate you, Chad, and tell us how we can pray for you.
Oh, I would ask that the Lord give me and our family continue to give us the grace to accept His will, His comfort amongst it, and courage to walk in it, regardless of what it may be.
And we will pray that for you and your family, for all the blessings and graces that you guys need most. You're a holy family, and may God continue to form you and shape you into the family He's called you to be. Thanks again, Chad.
Thank you. God bless you, dude.
I'd like to ask you to hop over to davidlgray.info, become a sponsor there if you like, join my mailing list if you like, and visit the Gray Report while you're there for the latest news from a rigid Catholic lean.